For argument in the case of Union Pacific versus Martin.
May it please the court, I am Andrew Lowe, counsel for the petitioners, Union Pacific Railroad Company and Danny Dolan. As this court held in Vigil versus Franklin, the 1990 Premises Liability Act sets forth a comprehensive statement of the duties owed by a landowner to those who come upon the land. The issue in this case is whether that statement of duties in the statute abrogates two statutory defenses. First, comparative negligence of the plaintiff, and second, pro rata fault of a non-party. We submit that the two defenses are not abrogated, and indeed that the statutory analysis is relatively straightforward. The rule of construction is that where one statute is claimed to supersede or abrogate another, that abrogation will not be found unless the two statutes are irreconcilably in conflict. Here, there is no conflict, much less an irreconcilable one.
Is this truly a matter of first impression for this court? I mean, this is 20 years since the premises liability statute.
Your Honor, the first time that any court, to my knowledge, held that the premises liability statute superseded or abrogated these two statutory defenses was the trial court in this very case.
Okay.
So I believe this is a case of first impression here, yes. Here we think there is no conflict between these statutes and thus that they must both be given effect. The premises liability statute never mentions affirmative defenses and never mentions apportionment of fault. All it addresses is duty of the landowners. Thus, all three statutes easily can be applied simultaneously. Duties of the landowner are covered by the Premises Liability Act. Negligence of the plaintiff, if shown, is covered by comparative negligence. And
help me out. What happened in this particular case? How did it play out? Your client wanted the premises liability statute to apply and contended that the plaintiff was a trespasser, but
initially,
that's not what the jury found, right?
No, the court ruled as a matter of law that the plaintiff was an invitee. So Union Pacific requested jury instructions on both comparative negligence and pro rata fault of the third party, who was the individual in the other car behind the plaintiff and who pushed her onto the railroad track.
A pretty bizarre set of facts, right? She's in a safe zone even though the crossbar is on top of the hood of her car. Her boyfriend's behind there and he's wanting to try to clear her across the railroad tracks, and what he does is put her right on it, right in front of the train.
Yeah. As you know, there is a conflict between the two sides over the standard of review concerning the facts, and because we did not get our defense as we contend, and we think we're right about this, that the facts for purposes of this appeal have to be viewed in the light most favorable to Union Pacific, since it was our defenses that were denied. But our evidence was that the engineer, looking down the track, did not believe that he would hit the car, and he could actually see the car some 1,100 feet away. And he knows that the train is a certain width. He can compare that to the width of the ties. He knows the railroad crossing is even wider. He sees the car is even further away than the concrete railroad crossing. So he says to himself, we're not going to hit. And then when the train is only about 100 feet away from the crossing, Ms. Martin's boyfriend, who's in the vehicle behind him, apparently believing that there would be a collision, suddenly puts his car in gear and hits her from behind, pushes her forward, and as a result, the coupler of the locomotive strikes the right rear door of Miss Martin's car.
Well, Mr. Lowe, regardless of the view that must be taken given the standard of review, so perhaps not pertinent to how we resolve this issue, perhaps. Most of those facts you just stated are actually contested, is that not correct? So that another reasonable view of the facts would be that she was not in a safe zone and that the engineer did not stop when he should have. Is that correct without going into detail?
The plaintiffs do contend that Ms. Martin, when she stopped, was close enough to the rail that the train would have hit her. And they contend that it was perfectly reasonable for Mr. Verucci to try to push her across the tracks, and so they contend that neither Ms. Martin nor Mr. Verucci was negligent. So this is a fact issue, of course, concerning negligence, which should have been submitted to the jury to determine Ms. Martin's negligence and, of course, Mr. Verucci's negligence.
And the reason it makes a difference is if there's negligence on both sides, it can reduce the ultimate verdict. I mean, that's the problem.
That's the big problem. Yes, exactly, Your Honor. Just for example, here, Union Pacific was held 100% liable for all of Ms. Martin's injuries. But a perfectly rational outcome might have been that the jury could have found Union Pacific to be 20% at fault and each of the other two parties 40% at fault.
But are either or both of those two outcomes, the actual outcome and the perfectly reasonable one that you just referred to, had they been instructed differently, are either of those outcomes consistent with the version of facts that you stated to us a moment ago as viewing them in support of your theory here?
They are 100% consistent. Even if Ms. If your question is
well, I guess to try to narrow it down a little bit, is it seems that your version of the facts is consistent with no negligence on the part of the railroad or the engineer. That seems to have been rejected by the jury, regardless of whether they didn't have the opportunity to apportion. It does seem to be clear that the version that the engineer correctly perceived he could safely pass and was not negligent, that seems no longer on the table.
For purposes of retrial, if the case goes back, we certainly contend that everything is on the table. The jury was presented with a stark choice between Union Pacific 100% at fault or Union Pacific 0% at fault. They had to choose. There was no middle ground.
Well, but they also found that Union Pacific was acting in a willful and wanton manner, didn't they?
They did.
So, I mean, that's like beyond just negligence.
For purposes of punitive damages, they did find. Presumably, that was because the engineer did not apply the brakes, and the jury presumably thought he should have, which was what the plaintiffs argued. He, of course, did not apply the brakes because he thought, looking down the track, that the car was in the clear. In any event, our contention here today is that it would have made a very large difference if the two statutory defenses had been available. At a minimum, it potentially greatly reduces Union Pacific's damages. And, of course, under the comparative negligence statute, if the jury finds that the combined negligence of the non-party at fault and the plaintiff are greater than Union Pacific's fault, if I've got that right, then there is 0% liability for Union Pacific. So under the comparative negligence statute, because there's that 50% threshold, it is still possible for the jury to split up the percentages, assigning some to all, and yet for the ultimate judgment against Union Pacific to be zero. So we think that all issues are still on the table for a retrial, Your Honor. The statutory analysis that we think is appropriate is the one that has been adopted by the two more recent Court of Appeals decisions that have come out since the Court of Appeals decision in this case. And those are the DeWitt and Tucker decisions. Both of those cases had the opportunity to look at the Martin analysis, and they took the unusual step of rejecting that inside their own court. They found that it was unnecessary and analytically incorrect to analyze the statute based solely on an amendment which took place 16 years later. Instead, they adopted the very simple, straightforward statutory analysis that I have presented. No irreconcilable conflict, therefore give effect to all three statutes. I also say that that result is 100% consistent both with the legislative declaration that's right on the face of the statute and with the legislative history of the 1990 Act itself, which the Court of Appeals never considered. If you look at the legislative declaration right on the face of the statute, the very first paragraph says that one of the purposes of the Act is to promote a state policy of responsibility by both landowners and those who come upon the land. Well, plaintiffs in this case contend that comparative negligence never applies in a premises liability action under the 1990 Act. Well, if that's so, then a plaintiff would have no disincentive from a legal standpoint to avoid negligent conduct. The policy statement in the statute strongly suggests that the legislature intended for there to be a legal disincentive to those who come upon the land to act negligently. Therefore, the comparative negligence defense and, of course, the pro rata fault statutes should be available. Similarly, so that's from the legislative declaration, which is part of the actual statutory language. Now, my position is that you stop there.
Well, wait, let's talk about the premises liability statute itself and the gradations.
Yes.
Yeah, and talk to us about this trespasser invitee and what, significance those distinctions might have.
Your Honor, the plaintiffs have tried to assign significance to that distinction. For example, they claim that because she was found to be an invitee, that therefore, as a matter of law, she could not be at fault. But ultimately, in this case, we believe that the distinctions between the three has no significance to the outcome here.
Okay, well, why is she an invitee in this circumstance? Railroad right away?
Well, clearly she initially was an invitee when she first drove up because the railroad invites the public to cross the railroad tracks there for business purposes, which is the definition of an invitee. Union Pacific's contention at trial, rejected before it ever went to the jury, was that once the lights began to flash, and she failed to leave, and the gates then came down on the roof of her car, that she became a trespasser. Now, the trial judge disagreed, and he submitted to the jury as an invitee. So that's not the subject of our appeal here today. We're not asking you to overrule that.
Yes, but the highest obligation under the statute is to invitees, right?
Yes, absolutely. And that would be, if the trial court is correct that she was an invitee, then the jury was correctly instructed as to the landowner's duty, but our defense instructions were all rejected. So the jury never knew or never assigned a percentage negligence, if any, to Ms. Martin or to Mr. Verrucci. The jury didn't know that there was an option other than finding 100% for the plaintiff or 100% for the defendant.
Well, I'm confused because your client had a choice to make. They originally... they could have stuck with a negligence defense, which would have brought in comparative negligence, and it instead decided to assert this premises liability as a defense. So, you could have had exactly what you're asking for now in terms of the comparative liability instructions and all those things. So why isn't your client kind of stuck with that choice they made?
Well, because two reasons, Your Honor. First, this case is properly covered by the premises liability statute. It never should have been filed as a negligence case. And having gone to the premises liability statute, then the question is, are the defenses statutorily available? Merely because Union Pacific chose to ask for the coverage of the Premises Liability Act does not mean that they automatically submit themselves to an erroneous interpretation of the statute, depriving them unlawfully, I say, of their defenses. So they were entitled, I believe, to the coverage of the Premises Liability Act because they owned the land. And as our briefs, and I think I'm trying to present to you today, show, the statutory defenses are also available. Therefore, it was error to prevent the jury from assigning a percentage of fault to the other parties.
Mr. Lowe, that's another thing that's not on appeal here. Is that right, whether or not this should have been a negligence case? Everyone agrees that this is correctly a premises case.
Everyone agrees, Your Honor.
Let me ask you about Vigil, which I suppose is the elephant in the room. What about this whole common law defense? It seems to me that maybe you're relying on the fact that in Vigil we said, common law defenses have been subsumed by the statute, but you're taking the position that statutory defenses have not been. Is that an oversimplistic statement of your position, sir?
I wouldn't call it simplistic, Your Honor, but I would offer one amendment recognizing that you are the author of the majority opinion, but regardless, I would offer one amendment to the way you phrased the question, and that is that the holding of Vigil is not that all common law defenses are preempted. Rather, the holding is that all common law defenses to duties are preempted. And the opinion of the majority in that case emphasizes that point throughout the opinion. And so all Vigil holds is that, for example...
To landowner duties.
Landowner duties, correct. So there the duty in question was the open and obvious danger defense, and the argument there is the landowner had no duty because the danger was obvious. And so the holding in Vigil was, no, there are no common law defenses to duties unless they have been specifically adopted into the statute, as, for example, the attractive nuisance doctrine was.
Now, you're saying that here, instead of talking about landowner duties, that is what the landowner has to do to protect people who come onto his land, we're now talking about a different topic entirely, that is, what people who come onto the land, who are invited onto the land, have to do just to meet a certain standard of care. That is not be negligent, not put themselves in danger, even though they have been invited onto this land.
Yes. We're saying two things. We're saying exactly what Your Honor just said, which is that the statute is about landowner duties, and the defenses that we claim should have been given to the jury are about conduct of the plaintiff, not conduct of the landowner, and conduct of the third-party non-party. So different subjects, not covered by Vigil, and no conflict. We're also pointing out that Vigil was about common law defenses to duties, whereas here we're talking about statutory defenses, and that's important because there is a very, very stiff rule of construction about when you read one statute to abrogate another. So that is a legally significant point here. So I believe it was Justice Rice who said Vigil is the gorilla in the room, and that's certainly true because I hadn't addressed it. But maybe there's one other, which is the 2006 amendment to the statute and the presumption of change and the Powell case, which the plaintiffs rely on very heavily. Certainly, we acknowledge the Powell case. There is such a presumption of change. Our position, very simply, though, is that it's entirely irrelevant to the analysis.
What did that amendment do?
What that amendment did was to state that three particular statutory defenses shall be available in premises liability actions, and they are pro rata fault, comparative negligence, and assumption of the risk.
Okay.
So that amendment was adopted in direct response to the trial court's decision in this case. And it was an attempt by the legislature, successful I think, to simply reverse that decision. So what the plaintiffs are trying to do, though, is to take that very logical action by the legislature and, through a creative but I think incorrect application of this presumption of change, turn it into a way to win the case for them, which is never what the legislature intended.
Well, sure, that could have been a clarifying amendment saying we thought it was otherwise, right?
It certainly could have been, Your Honor. Even before you get to the amendment, our contention is that the Court of Appeals never should have looked at it. These statutes are clear enough on their face so that there's no need to go outside the face of the statute. But if we concede for the moment that the Premises Liability Act was ambiguous, the first place you go is not to an amendment that was passed 16 years later. You go to the standard tools for statutory construction, including legislative history of the original statute, construction with other statutes, purpose of the legislature in passing the statute, and so on. Those tools have been listed many times in the decisions of this case. So the Court of Appeals goes beyond the face of the statute and then bypasses all of those tools, goes directly to the amendment passed 16 years later, and relies 100% on that amendment and nothing else. And they say, we know that, they say so in the opinion. That, we think, was error. This court has never approved such a procedure. Let me address directly, what is the purpose of the presumption of change? As in Powell, the purpose of the presumption is to help with the analysis when the issue is, does the amendment apply in this case? There, a court faced with that issue has to decide whether the amendment constitutes a change or a clarification. Because if it's a change, it may affect vested rights or impose new duties, and therefore cannot be applied retrospectively. So it's very important when that's an issue. But in this case, it was undisputed that the amendment did not apply here. The amendment was irrelevant to our case. It did not apply. And therefore, it was not the proper place to go. This presumption legally should not have been used to construe, not the amendment, but a statute that had been passed 16 years earlier. Let me point out just what should be really quite evident, and that is that to the extent that we rely on the amendment to tell us, as lawyers and courts, what the intent of the legislature was 16 years earlier, there is an unspoken assumption that the legislature in 2006 knew what the legislative intent was 16 years earlier. But there's no basis for that assumption. There's no record that suggests that the 2006 legislature did any research or asked anyone or did anything to interpret, to find out what the intent of the legislature was in 1990. So if they didn't know, then it makes no sense for us to defer to some presumption based on the amendment and say, well, it must have been a change. They don't even know if it was a change because they don't know what the legislative intent was 16 years earlier. They're nowhere near as well equipped as this court is to examine legislative history records and to determine legislative intent. Indeed, that's a judicial function, not a legislative function, to go back and to construe a statute that was passed at that time 16 years ago and now, of course, more.
Counsel, before you move on, can I ask you, just, I know you said that we shouldn't even look to that later amendment, but can you help me understand why that is? I mean, somehow it would be improper for us to look at that later amendment.
I'm not saying that the court should be 100% barred ever from looking at it. What I am saying is that it would be the very, very last place that the court would look. There are a couple of examples, the Frank M. Hall case, for example, where this court did look at a subsequent amendment in when they were construing an older statute. But always, always, Frank M. Hall, Douglas County, and other cases, the court had gone through a full statutory analysis first, case of the statute, secondary sources, reached a tentative conclusion, and then just took a quick look at this amendment to see whether that was consistent. So at best, it is a tertiary source for construing.
Remind me of Powell, is that the one where the kid got near the open canal ditch and drowned?
Yes, there were two kids, yes, that's right.
Two of them.
There were two cases, correct.
And we held that basically the, what was it, the city was liable? Remind me.
No. You held in favor of the cities. There was Powell 1 and Powell 2.
Right.
The first one construed the original statute. The second one held that the legislative amendment, which stated that irrigation ditches and water courses were not sanitation facilities.
Right.
And therefore, that would have been in favor of the plaintiff, and she, if applicable, she would have been able to use that to sue. And this court held that it was a change in the law. It was not a clarification. It applied the presumption, and therefore, that amendment did not apply in the very case, and Mrs. Powell, the boy's mother, was not permitted to use the amendment in that case in order to sue the municipal defendants.
Well, I think your answer is correct that didn't apply, but I thought the statutory change went the other way. She benefited from the original one and would not benefit from the later change.
The original statute.
Well, we're talking about the definition of governmental immunity.
We were talking about the definition of the term sanitation facilities,
right.
I believe,
and
under
which,
the
which things that were waived.
Right, and this court ultimately held that the statute was clear in the first case. And then it went back for further proceedings. And then on further proceedings, Mrs. Powell claimed that she should be able to sue under the amendment, which was in her favor, is my recollection. And I believe what it said is that sanitation facilities mean facilities that are designed to process waste, essentially, and do not include water courses, irrigation ditches, and sanitation ditches. So that would have meant that those ditches in which her son drowned were not part of the sanitation facilities, and therefore that there was no municipal immunity. And so she naturally said, I now want to proceed based on the amendment. And ultimately, this court held, no, the amendment is not retroactive. It does not apply to your case, which arose before the amendment, and you cannot use that to support your case. So the main point that I'm trying to make here is that there is a huge distinction, materially significant distinction, between Powell and our case.
And let me key off of that and get you back to where I think you want to go. So you said that, in your opinion, there's no conflict among the statutes, that premises liability is completely consistent with comparative negligence, and therefore there's not a conflict, and therefore we shouldn't really be looking at any legislative aids at all. Is that right?
That is 100% correct.
But if we were to find a conflict, we shouldn't look at the Powell series of cases, because those are too late in time and probably a clarification instead of a change in any event. What if we do find a conflict? We're back in 1990 when premises liability was passed. Where do we go?
I would suggest that you go straight to the 1990 legislative history, and in fact, really it's the 1986 legislative history, because virtually all the language was put in the statute in 1986. This is part of this long history of premises liability. As you probably recall, we used to have at common law the three-tier system, trespasser, licensee, invitee. That was overruled in Mile High Fence versus Radovich in 1971, replaced with a simple negligence standard. So in 1986, as our adversaries point out, the legislature was concerned that it had become too easy for trespassers to sue landowners. And for that reason, among others, and in the spirit of tort reform, which was that legislature, 1986, the legislature adopted Premises Liability Act, which reinstated the common law statuses, different standards for different statuses, and adopted the pro rata fault statute at the same time, and amended the comparative negligence statute at the same time. All three statutes were before the legislature at the very same time. If the legislature had intended for the two defenses, pro rata and comparative negligence, not to apply to premises liability, they surely would have said so. In any event,
we only have an absence of them saying so. We don't have an affirmative statement of any sort that they meant to include them.
No, they certainly not, Your Honor. Then this would be a really easy case. But what we do have is we know pretty clearly what the legislature was trying to accomplish. It was the tort reform year. They had the feeling was that the pendulum had swung too far in the favor of plaintiffs and too much liability. And so the whole movement that year was reduction of liability. And in this particular case, to make it harder for trespassers to sue landowners, it makes no sense to construe the action that they took as a result to make it easier for trespassers to sue landowners by sweeping away all of the landowners' statutory defenses, and in fact, by enabling plaintiffs to achieve a double recovery, as they would here. Because remember, they settled with Mr. Verrucci, and because there was no percentage of allocation by the jury, Union Pacific was completely unable to get a set-off from its judgment as a result of the settlement with Mr. Verrucci. So the plaintiffs would get a substantial double recovery, and certainly that would have been contrary to the legislative intent in 1990 as well. I see I'm running short of time, and I would prefer to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
You may.
Thank you.
Madam Chief Justice, members of the court, my name is Richard Westfall. I'm appearing here today on behalf of Maureen Martin and her family, her parents. Appearing with me at council table is Mr. Glenn Gordon, who is one of the trial lawyers in the case. On the morning of November 12, 2002, Ms. Martin was driving to school in Castle Rock. Her car stalled at a railroad grade crossing near her school, and a Union Pacific train ran her down. Ms. Martin suffered catastrophic injuries as a result of the collision. Martin brought a negligence case against Union Pacific, and for almost 2 years, the case was litigated as a negligence case. And Union Pacific, as Chief Justice Mularkey pointed out, had available to it all of the comparative liability statutes that it's arguing it's entitled to today. On the eve of trial, Union Pacific moved to convert the case to a premises liability action, almost certainly so that it could assert that Ms. Martin was a trespasser.
How to do that? Amended the what was it?
Motion.
Yeah, a motion to do what?
Justice Hobbs, it was a motion for summary judgment.
Okay.
Asserting that the premises liability case was the exclusive.
So ask the court for a ruling of law, basically shaping up the case for the trial and the jury instructions that were going to be given by the judge to the jury.
That's my recollection. Just this came out of the blue. A lot of the pretrial work had been done, and then out of the blue, they file a motion for summary judgment on the eve of trial.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Westphal, you're not suggesting, are you, that there was something inappropriate about that? I mean, really, isn't it both sides not recognizing that this shouldn't be a negligence action but had to be under the Premises Liability Act until that issue was finally raised by the railroad?
Justice Martinez, I think it actually should be relevant to the harmless error analysis, and I'll address that later in my comments if I have time.
Okay.
It was certainly a novel idea at the time to turn a railroad grade crossing typical negligence case into a premises case. So
is there an alternative? Are you suggesting there's an alternative?
We are not in any way challenging the trial court's ruling, transforming the case into a premises case. It was litigated as a premises case. We believe the verdict was a jury verdict was properly entered against them as the case was tried as a premises case, Justice Martinez. The trial court concluded that Ms. Martin was an invitee under the Colorado Premises Liability Act, that there was no evidence that Ms. Martin was negligent, and the jury concluded that Union Pacific, not Vincent Verrucci, was the cause of Ms. Martin's injuries. The jury also concluded that Union Pacific, as was pointed out, acted wantonly and willfully and assessed punitive damages.
Maybe I misheard you. How did they conclude that there was no evidence that Ms. Martin, was negligent? That maybe I just totally misheard what you said. How would that issue have even been presented to them?
I think I would urge Justice Rice for the court to go back and look at specifically a couple of places, particularly volume 19, and the pages, I think there are 85 through 114, where there's the colloquy about the jury instructions. And I think it's very informative in the give and take that took place between counsel for Union Pacific, counsel for Ms. Martin, and the trial court as they're walking through how do you take a case that had been originally litigated and brought up as a negligence case and actually try this and try this case fairly as a premises liability case and let all the evidence in.
I suspect it would have been very difficult. But did I hear you correctly to say that the jury actually made a finding that Ms. Martin was not negligent?
The trial court made a finding that the instructions that were being sought for Ms. Martin to go forward trying to assert negligence, the jury instructions, were rejected, and they were rejected on two bases, and that's set forth in those pages of the record.
But it was that issue was never presented to the jury under any other guise. The jury was never asked to make a finding as to Ms. Martin's culpability, right?
That is correct.
Thank you.
What about the third party? You also said the third party, Mr. Westphal. Was there? I didn't quite understand. How did the jury determine that?
The jury was able to make it. I think the best thing to do is look at it from the standpoint of looking how the statute reads, and I think if you look at that and then look at what the trial court tried to do, the statute looks at for an invitee, except as otherwise provided in subsection 2 of this paragraph C, an invitee may recover for damages caused by the landowner's unreasonable failure to exercise reasonable care to protect against dangers of which he actually knew or should have known. What the trial court did is make it clear that Union Pacific would be allowed at every turn to argue that it did not unreasonably fail to exercise reasonable care because Ms. Martin was in the clear and Mr. Verrucci caused the accident, that there was no danger. Again, the statute speaks to protect against dangers of which he actually knew or should have known. You'll see that the trial court went to great lengths to listening to Union Pacific's theory of the case to give them their theory, but try to do so within the confines of subsection 3C of the premises liability statute and say, you can make that claim that, you know, that there's no danger. You can make the claim that there's no causation. All of those defenses that you want to put in, that you would typically do in a negligence case, I'm going to let you make those arguments to the jury and introduce that evidence, but you're going to have to do so within the confines of Section 3C of the premises liability.
So as I understand it, you're saying that basically all these issues were argued as a fact matter to the jury.
That's correct.
Determination of danger, causation, and so forth. Is that right?
That is correct, Justice.
But the instructions were not given.
That is correct, Justice Kennedy.
Let me follow up just one second and make sure I understand. Take you back to Justice Rice's question then. So the jury, so there was no jury finding that the victim was not negligent, but you said the trial judge denied the instruction on two grounds, and you didn't get a chance to finish further what those were. Was, are you saying one of them was that there was no evidence of negligence?
That's correct. And the trial court referred to its earlier finding that Ms. Martin was an invitee and said any of the evidence, either Union Pacific witnesses, any of the witnesses that were involved in the case, they all say that once that she was trapped in the situation in her stalled vehicle, that she was just trying to get the heck out of there. And that did not constitute evidence of fault or negligence on her part that would warrant getting a jury instruction on their behalf.
I understand you to be saying then that this issue that's before us about denial of the comparative negligence instruction because it's not allowed in premises liability was only an alternate basis for denying that instruction? And
with respect to Ms. Martin, that is correct.
What about Verrucci?
With respect to the other person, Mr. Verrucci?
Yeah.
I don't believe that there was a specific finding that there was no negligence on the part of Mr. Verrucci as a basis for denial. It's my recollection of the record on that.
But in any event, and I know we're belaboring this, in any event, the trial judge was never asked to make a finding as a matter of law that the comparative negligence defense was not available because it was not supported by fact. And therefore, there would be no instruction going to the jury.
Only with respect to Ms. Martin.
And there is that specific finding in the record?
Yes, there is. Okay. And that's cited in our brief.
Thank you.
Let me get to the 2006 amendment, which is something that I understand both from the briefs and also Mr. Lowe's comment to you today, is all trying to say that this court cannot, or at least should not, look at the amendment in any way, shape, size, or form in informing itself of what the statute meant prior to the 2006 amendment. And I respectfully submit to you that is flat out wrong. And the reason it's wrong, there's a number of reasons, but let me hit a couple of them. The first one is that the General Assembly has answered the very question that is now before you today. The General Assembly has spoken and explicitly said in premises liability cases that the comparative liability statutes, the very ones that they are saying that they were entitled to pre-2006 amendment, shall henceforth, beginning April of 2006, shall be applicable in premises liability cases. So for Union Pacific to win, they have got to show that it's a, quote, clarification. And they have avoided this, obviously, at every turn. And I think the reason's pretty obvious, given the quality of the lawyers on the other side. This is not by omission. This is as a result of the fact that they know that if they really truly take this issue head on, and really truly look at the 2006 amendment and address it, they can't show that it is in fact a clarification and not a change in the law, because it is patent from the language of the amendment itself. And looking at the statute prior to the amendment, that those comparative liability defenses that they keep wanting to call, I assert, are very much part of establishing liability and this court's opinion in Slack and in a host of other areas, it's clear that the comparative liability is a way of apportioning fault to the parties. It is, in fact, a way of establishing liability. And if you look at the premises liability statute pre-amendment, it is very clear that liability could be established only as set forth in subsection 3 and only using the very clear status-based system that's set forth in Section 3C. They did not mention Powell at all in their petition for certiorari. They did not cite Powell at all in their opening brief. And in their reply brief, they try to take on Powell and by saying, gosh, gee whiz, and I think I heard that in the argument to the court here today. Gosh, gee whiz, it's just really, you know, we don't have to worry about that because in Powell, the law was clear before. And by the way, I disagree. I think Chief Justice Malarkey, I think your recall of the opinion is correct. The plaintiffs were successful below, right, and they tried to grant, and the city's moved for a motion to dismiss, trying to rely upon the very amendment saying it did change the outcome. And this court, despite the fact that the General Assembly itself added in a legislative declaration that this amendment is to clarify that portion of the law with respect to making sanitation facilities subject to the Governmental Immunity Act, that wasn't good enough. And I think, you know, if clarification in the legislative declaration of the amendment itself isn't good enough to transform an amendment that's clearly designed to address pending litigation, then I think a fortiori, the plain language of the amendment that we have here in our 2006 amendment clearly constituted a change was not a clarification. And Union Pacific just can't overcome that presumption and that burden.
Mr. Westfall, could I interrupt you one second and just take that position? But let me pose for you a third possibility here, because we don't seem to just be dealing with the passage of a statute initially and then an amendment of that statute and whether the amendment was intended to clarify it or change it. In between, we've got a ruling by this court, which I think it seems clear this amendment was in response to.
The appeal decision, yes, Justice.
Yes. Does it make a difference for purposes of the analysis if it is clear what the legislature was trying to do was undo what we did in Vigil? Now, you've talked in terms of a clarification, but if it is clear what they were trying to do was change the situation from what we decided in Vigil, mm-hmm. would you call that a clarification, or that is in effect a change on their part, but one which doesn't indicate a change in the way the statute was before Vigil? And if the legislature was wrong, or maybe was being cautious in deciding what the scope of our Vigil opinion was, would that make a difference in terms of their intent to either clarify or change the pre-Vigil statute?
I think if this court looks at both Powell and the Douglas County decision, in Powell, you had a situation where the court, at least there's some evidence that some members of the General Assembly were trying to do exactly what you're talking about, saying we had these decisions with respect to that, where this court clarified what constituted sanitation facilities, and we're going to go back and we're going to make it, quote, clear that sanitation facilities would include these drain pipes that were at issue in those respective litigations. And this court rejected that and said, no, that really was a change, because you are clearly changing the statute to add this particular type of water conduit to the definition of sanitation facilities. With respect to Douglas County, and I think this is an important point, because I think Union Pacific has it, you know, even when they belatedly try to address the issue in their reply brief, Union Pacific tries to say, well, Powell, you distinguish Powell just because of the fact that in Powell, the previous statute was clear, and in our situation, there's an argument with respect to ambiguity, which is what the Court of Appeals found below, but did so on the basis of conflicting schemes, not based upon the plain language of the statute. And in Douglas County, what this court did was said, look, even in the situation where you're trying to just clear things up, the presumption still applies, that it's a change in the law. And for the host of reasons that are set forth in the opinion, that, you know, there's a presumption of prospectivity, there's a presumption from constitutional grounds against retroactivity, there's a bunch of policy reasons and constitutional reasons that are attendant, in addition to the rules of construction that have been adopted by this court over the years, that do dictate that be viewed as a change.
Let me ask one follow-up. Assuming that's right, we go with you there, that it's a change. Does it make a difference, though, whether it's a change from what the legislature thought the law was after Vigil, or whether it's a change from what the law was before Vigil?
Which I want to ask you a follow-up question on exactly that point as well, which is what I was thinking. Don't we have to figure out what the legislature thought Vigil held, to figure out whether it's a change or clarification?
I respectfully submit no, Justice Rice.
Why not? Isn't that the same question that Justice Coates is asking?
I think at the end of the day, and that's why we're here, at the end of the day, the General Assembly makes its call. The General Assembly clearly did something in response to Vigil, and they changed the statute. Now, it's incumbent upon this court to say, is there sufficient, using all of your rules of construction, and looking at the 86 original version, the fact that it was overturned by Gallegos, the reenactment, walking through the entire legislative history of all of that, and looking at the plain language of the measure itself, it, this court should, you know, makes its own determination as a matter of law whether what that 86 and 90 statute said and did, and whether that 86 and 90 statute allowed for comparative liability, and we respectfully submit that it does not.
I understand. Mr. Westfall, I just want to ask you one question just to make sure I absolutely get it. The legislature in 2006 doesn't help us as to why they made the change they did. We don't have any legislative history there, really. Is that correct?
I disagree, Justice Rice.
Okay.
The amendment, the language of the amendment, which is what the Court of Appeals below relied upon.
Right.
I agree with a lot of the criticism that's been leveled over the years that with respect to individual statements by legislators and committee reports and what have you, a lot of that can be monkeyed with and played around with. That's why it's important for this court to look at what the actual amendment itself says and does and compare that to the way that the statute read before the amendment.
Okay, and the language that we're talking about is just this sentence, which says these sections shall apply, and that's it, right?
That's correct, and also the effective date language, and both the fact that it was mandatory, that these provisions shall apply. Let's for a moment. I think it's illustrative. Let's look at the way the statute read before the amendment, and then let's add the amendment. And I think that, setting aside the Powell and Douglas County line of analysis, I think just reading the words, interpreting the statute plainly, if you will, pre and post amendment, I think is quite illustrative. This is the way Section 2 read before the amendment. In any civil action brought against a landowner by a person, who alleges injury occurring while on the real property of another, and by reason of the condition of such property, or activities conducted, or circumstances existing on such property, pretty broad, the landowner shall be liable only as provided in subsection 3 of this section. That's the way it read after the 1990 reenactment. And that's the way it read as it was applicable to this case at the time that the accident occurred. Now, this is what was added. It was a very short amendment. It appeared on just one paragraph of one page of a bill. Sections 13-21-111, comparative, 1321-111.5, pro rata, non-party, and 1321-111.7, shall apply to an action to which this section applies. I think if you just look at the language of the premises liability statute, pre-amendment and post-amendment, and the amendment itself is an independent basis of statutory construction, reveals that it clearly is a change in the law, that those terms did not exist prior to the time that the General Assembly decided.
But those statutes existed. I mean, these aren't brand new statutes. They existed at the time the 1990 premises liability was written. So
that is true.
So all that, at least one could argue that what that does is it's almost circular. I mean, don't all statutes always apply? And so what are they doing when they say that it will apply, unless they're responding to VHIL, which of course they were, and perhaps what they were understanding about VHIL is that, well, certain common law defenses to duties don't apply, but just in case anybody got confused, we're clarifying that these statutes, which have always existed, still apply. And I agree that your language is shall apply as opposed to still apply, but shall apply.
I think I can answer your question.
Please.
By touching upon three what I consider to be cornerstone arguments that they've argued in their briefs and that they've urged here to the court today. And if I can address each of those three points very quickly, I think I can take head on the substance of your question, Justice
Thank you.
Rice.
Thank you.
First, their first point is that the pre-2006 amendment was silent with respect to the comparative liability statutes.
I'm sorry, it was what?
The pre-2006 amendment, I mean, the pre-2006 premises liability statute was silent with respect to these comparative liability provisions that are set forth in the statute. I respectfully submit that the language that I have read to you shall be liable only as set forth in subsection 3. And this court's discussion of the comprehensiveness and exhaustiveness quality of the premises liability statute, which was done in VHIL, described, and in fact, that was the basis for concluding, it was the comprehensive and exhaustive nature of the premises liability statute, which gave rise to the decision that the common law defense of open and obvious danger did not apply. That was a necessary part of the holding. And so to say that somehow or another the Premises Liability Act was silent when it says shall be liable only in subsection 3 in any civil action involving the landowner facts that give rise to the statute, that's not silence. Second point, with respect to the point that's being made that both in the briefs and in the argument today, that somehow or another the Premises Liability Statute is a duty statute, and nothing more than duties, I just respectfully disagree. I mean, looking at page 5 of the Union Pacific reply brief, they make the following statement, which I think tracks the argument that they were making before you today. While the 1990 Act comprehensively defines the duties owed by landowners to trespassers, licensees, and invitees, the Act says nothing about other elements of liability, such as causation. Section 3, the comprehensive and exhaustive liability scheme, which is set forth in the statute based upon trespasser, licensee, or invitee, talks about every one of those elements. Let me look to the invitee section for a moment because that's what's at issue in this case. And that's subsection 3C, 1. Except as otherwise provided in subparagraph 2, which deals with agricultural land, this paragraph C, an invitee may recover for damages, so there has to be damages, cause, there has to be causation, and what has to cause those damages? By the landowner's unreasonable failure to exercise reasonable care to protect against dangers of which he actually knew or should have known. Every aspect for establishing liability under the premises liability statute is set forth completely and exhaustively in the premises liability statute itself. And to say that somehow or another that the Premises Liability Act is merely limited to duties, I understand where they're getting that. They're getting it from looking at the VHIL opinion, but the VHIL opinion was focusing on duties because that what was at issue was the open and obvious danger doctrine, which is a defense to owing a duty. That's why the opinion talks about duties. It doesn't in any way undermine the comprehensive and exhaustive character of the premises liability statute itself, which was discussed in VHIL, and which is clearly apparent just from looking at the plain language of the Premises Liability Act. The last point that they make, that I think gets to the heart of this, is the issue of somehow or another Union Pacific's defenses have been abrogated. There is no abrogation of any defense going on in this situation. I respectfully submit that when you have a broad statute that applies to a host of situations involving injury to person or property, and that you somehow, and then you say, we're going to say there's a different set of rules that apply, in this case, the premises liability context, that merely not applying in a more general provisions to a more narrow and specific set of facts is in no way abrogating anything. It's just not applying it in the situation that's specifically enumerated in the statute itself. There's a couple of good examples of this, one of which is what they put in their own reply brief, and that is the idea of the Make My Day law. There's subsection 4 of that specifically allows for complete civil immunity if you meet the requirements of the Make My Day law. That would be a narrow specific...
Mr. Westfall, I'm sorry to interrupt you. You're already getting close, but how do you construe the caused in C1? I mean, weren't they deprived of their right to have a jury make that specific determination that they were really not, they didn't cause the damages, they were caused by other things, such as
they could argue
third party? Well, but if you don't have an instruction, it's good to argue it, but...
There was a causation instruction.
Well, what are the causation, how did the causation instruction take into account the aspect of, say, Bruce, I don't know how to pronounce his name, his conduct?
It took into consideration that they could find that Vinnie Verrucci was the cause and not Union Pacific.
Specifically how?
Well, here's the problem, is it was an up-and-down instruction, right? He either caused it, therefore, no liability, or he didn't cause it, therefore, liability. Isn't that the way the instruction was phrased?
It does essentially provide for an either-or situation. And it was proper in this situation because that's the way Union Pacific chose to defend itself in this case. Once this case was transformed into a premises case, and once there was numerous colloquies, there was, you know, pre-motions practice before the trial court, and once the jury instructions and the colloquy with the judge, you know, they were able to get all of their evidence in and made the closing argument.
Now that's why you said earlier on, you alluded to harmless error at the very beginning of what you said. In other words, they had all the facts before them. They could have believed that he caused it by shoving his girlfriend's car right in the in the track of the train, and the jury found otherwise, that it was because the engineer never at any time applied the brakes and took any precaution to slow down.
That, and the fact that there was a lot of evidence that she was on or dangerously close to the tracks, and a lot of evidence that they changed their stories.
Right.
Which really, I think, went to a heart of why there was a want and willful determination in this case, because I think the jury saw through the change in the stories.
But, Ms. Westphal, I want to be clear. You did say that the record reflects that the trial court found that she was not negligent, right?
That is correct. With respect to Ms. Martin, that's correct. And that's set forth in our brief.
And you said that we can look through that at volume 1985 through 114?
That will be part of volume 19 between pages 85 and 114. I can't remember the exact page.
Can you go back to you were making a point about the Make My Day law?
With respect to the Make My Day law, that's an example where you're not applying a general provision regarding to large premises liability, or in this case, perhaps even you would clearly allow the civil immunity provision, which is a narrow subset, to take place. Another example, and this is a key case, and I'm glad, thank you very much, Chief Justice Marlecki, for bringing me back to this area. A key case that we cite in our brief that they ignore, and I think it's a very telling point, is BG's Inc. versus Gross. Because there, this court has held explicitly that the Salation statute, which was a subset of the larger issue of apportioning liability, that the comparative liability did not apply to the Salation statute, and I call the court's attention to that. I'm running out of time. Let me make a couple of key points in conclusion. With respect to the legislative history of the 86 and 90 statutes in response to a question, we have spent numerous pages walking the court through both the pre-86 scheme, Mile High, 86 statute, Gallegos, the reenactment, and all of the committee discussion about that, and showing that this, in fact, that the 86 and 90 statutes had a number of things. Number one, it was focused on trespassers. Number two, it was a rejection of Mile High and negligence principles. Number three, that the liability was to be determined solely based upon status and nothing else. And that scheme was inconsistent, particularly regarding trespassers, with comparative liability. And that we go to great lengths to discuss that. They respond to that with a half a page, page 9, essentially dismissing that entire analysis. I'm afraid I'm out of time, Chief Justice.
I'd like to make two brief points in rebuttal. First, I would like to address what the legislature did with respect to the Vigil case. I agree with Justice Rice's formulation of what happened, but I kind of wanted to address Justice Coates' question from before. The legislature did not reverse Vigil. The amendment in 2006 does not reestablish the open and obvious common law defense to duty. What the legislature was reacting to was the misinterpretation of Vigil by the trial court in this case. Then I want to go briefly recite and address this question of the trial court's ruling concerning Ms. Martin's negligence. There is a passage in the record where the trial court comments that he doesn't think there's any evidence of Ms. Martin's negligence. it's clearly incorrect. We have a de novo standard of review on that. That was akin to granting a directed verdict. The evidence that we submitted was essentially that she was negligent because when she drove up to the crossing, the lights were already flashing.
Wait a second. That wasn't appealed, right? That's not part of this case.
Well, I'm responding to what I perceive to be their allegation of harmless error. I'm not asking you to reverse that statement. But
we have to take that statement as being true, right?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Why not?
That's essentially granting a directed verdict on a disputed issue of fact. And so all inferences would have to be drawn in our favor, and there's a de novo standard of review. So if I could briefly recite the evidence, I think it might help.
Hold on. Before you do that, I'm sorry. Are you suggesting that that's merely a statement as opposed to a ruling on a specific motion? And I guess the question Justice Rice posed before to Mr. Westfall was there a specific motion, and was this ruling on a motion? Can you help us with that?
As far as I recall from the record, there was no specific motion asking the judge to rule that there was no negligence by Ms. Martin. In the jury instruction conference, there is a passage where the judge says, well, basically, I'm not submitting your defense instructions concerning comparative negligence and pro rata fault because of Vigil. And then he goes on and says, but I don't think there's any negligence of Ms. Martin's, I don't think there's any evidence of Ms. Martin's negligence anyway. Union Pacific submitted extensive evidence of her negligence. Very briefly, the lights were flashing.
I think your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Appreciate comments, and on behalf of the court, I want to thank counsel for your arguments. The case stands submitted, and the court.